Canadian grade 6 history students since the 1970s have heard about Leif Erikson, the Viking who made it to Canada, stayed a while, and left. At first, I didn't appreciate the importance of this major rewriting of colonial history. I didn't know much about the details or that my family, including my spouse, has genetic ties to several Norse settlers in Greenland and Iceland. The very settlements that Leif Erikson and his father, Erik the Red, were from. Even more amazing, these various connections span from 925 CE to 1678 CE. That story I first heard in grade 6 suddenly became much more interesting to me. I want to share this story with my family and anyone else who wants to listen, because it is a story that, if fleshed out with details from oral Inuit histories, can offer insight into the personal work that may be a prerequisite for reconciliation. Welcome to the Maple Family Treehouse. I'm Kale, and I'm here sharing stories from my family tree to better understand my own colonial presence here in North America. If you've listened to some of my earlier episodes, you might remember that not only am I building my family tree using traditional means, but I'm also comparing the DNA of my family to ancient DNA samples acquired through archaeological research. It is through this comparison that I know my family members are related to at least 14 settlers from Iceland and Greenland. Before I jump into today's story, I want to give a shout out to the Million Mito project that was launched by Roberta Estes in 2020. It is through the published work of this research that I was able to access some interesting details about two of the burials relevant to my family. I have provided links to the two articles that explain the Iceland burials in detail, so check those out. One burial the group analyzed was a traditional boat burial, and you may have heard of Viking boat burials, so this may not sound too surprising, but the DNA testing done on this individual revealed that they had Celtic origins, meaning that they were most likely a captive taken during a raid in Scotland and Ireland. Now, other individuals with similar heritage were buried in unmarked graves. The grave itself is an indicator of the status in the community that this person had. This is a surprising find provides a rare glimpse into this ancient community, cautioning us against stereotyping or simplifying the social relationships and structures that made the burial possible. In another burial from 1704 that my mother and spouse are linked to, two individuals, a female aged 40 and a male aged 26, were executed for plotting and carrying out the murder of the female's husband. The male was beheaded and his head was severed and put on public display, while the female was drowned, and after their executions were carried out, both bodies were burned on unconsecrated ground. And while these details may be difficult to hear, they provide valuable insight into the justice system of a community infamous for its violence. So the slide here shows you the connections that each one of my family members that are relevant to the story have to the Icelandic burials that I'll show you on a map on the next slide. The research I just discussed was limited to Iceland, and I wanted to include this map to give you a sense of the time and space of early Icelandic settlements and the exact location of the burials. Again, I've provided a link of the map source in the show notes and on the slide, and I'm now posting the show notes on Facebook, by the way, so you can find them there. Okay, back to our story. Iceland is where the Norse began their settlement, but they soon expanded westward. The place where Leif Erikson made camp was on the northwestern shore of Newfoundland, Canada. The specific location is now called L'Anse aux Meadows. The Viking structures found there are indicative of a camp to repair ships and process resources for trade. It is estimated that the camp was used for about 10 years and then abandoned. A short span of time compared to the settlement in Greenland, where Leif was born. His father, Eric the Red, intended to establish permanent settlements out of necessity. Eric had been exiled from Iceland for murders he committed, and returning to Norway was not an option for Leif, because his father, Thorvald, had been exiled from Norway for a murder he committed. For these early migrants, Greenland and Iceland were lifelines to start again, with intentions to supply ivory and furs to Europe. So the adventurous seeking heroes I heard about in history class so long ago were more like desperate refugees who abandoned their settlements as mounting factors made life in these settlements impossible. Things like a mini ice age, violent relations with Inuit communities in Greenland and the Botuk people in Newfoundland, expensive investments that accompanied conversions to Christianity, as well as growing competition in the ivory trade from Africa. This is a moment in colonial history that reads like a parable from the pages of A Brother's Grimm story. I did not get this perspective from my early history lessons, but the message is clear today. I do not remember hearing about the complete annihilation of the Botuk people, or how the Inuit communities in Greenland had thrived for thousands of years prior to meeting the European settlers. Thanks to the oral histories passed on for more than 1,000 years, we have a more complete understanding of the relations between the Inuit Greenlanders and the Norse settlers. I want to share two specific oral histories published by Kirsten Thisted in 2001. The first story is representative of common features in many Inuit oral histories about Norse settlers. The second story is an outlier, but it may suggest other possible factors that ended Norse settlement in Greenland, so I'll include both. In the first story, the Inuit people first met ancient Norsemen when they approached the coast of Nuuk on an umiak, which is a skin boat. The Inuit were surprised to see a huge house and people they didn't recognize. The Norsemen were friendly, so the Inuit cautiously introduced themselves, but did not stay long. Later, a larger group of Inuit made a second visit, and a friendly relationship was established. As a result of their friendship, two men, an Inuk and a Norseman, engaged in archery competitions. During one contest, the Norseman suggested that they climb a high mountain to see who could hit a caribou skin target below. Whoever failed would be thrown over the cliff. The Inuk, at first, rejected the challenge, since they were friends, and he saw no reason for one of them to be killed. The Norseman persisted and ultimately missed the target, while the Inuk put his arrow right through the center of the skin. Accepting the agreed-upon outcome, the Norseman was pushed from the cliff, which was thereafter called Pisisaktvik, the place of archery. When the Inuit and the Norsemen had begun to live side by side and understood one another's language, an Inuit girl, Navarnak, went to live in the household of the Norsemen as a kifk, a servant. Navarnak was an evil liar who pitted the Norsemen and the Inuit against each other, telling each one that the other was planning an attack. The Norsemen believed her and attacked the Inuit at their summer camp. When they arrived, all the men were hunting caribou. They were away, but nonetheless killed everyone in sight. Two women fled, but one fell behind because she was carrying her baby in her amat, an extended hood of her pelt. Her previous children did not survive early childhood, so she was determined to keep this child alive. The woman, Amarnak, She, who was carrying a baby in her amet for the first time, ran for her life. When she finally collapsed from exhaustion, both she and the child were killed. Amarnak was beheaded, and when the Inuit men returned, the surviving woman related what happened. Amarnak's husband, beside himself with grief and anger, traveled to the various settlements to find a skilled magician. Upon finding one, he took him to his village, and they hatched a plan. They built a large umiak to carry many men. When finished, the boat was covered with white skins, joined to others of a slightly darker hue, so that at a distance it looked like a piece of dirty floating ice. The boat was fitted so that those on board could let it break into pieces, like a small calving iceberg. The various pieces, with the men still concealed, would each drift ashore. The boat builder rehearsed the procedure with the other men that would join him, and they set out to seek revenge. The Norsemen had, however, fled their settlements and had gathered in Amaralik, a fjord just south of Nuuk. And as they approached, the Inuit saw how vigilantly the Norsemen kept guard. When one went inside, another immediately took his place. The boat, though, kept drifting up the fjord until one of the guards began peering in the direction of the boat. Shading his eyes with his hand, he finally shouted, "Here comes the Greenlanders!" The Norsemen raced out, but one of them was heard to say, "It was not a boat, it's just an ice floe." And at that moment, Amarnak's husband ordered his men to let the boats calve, and the Norsemen concluded that there was no danger. The magician then sang a magic song to prevent the Norsemen from leaving their house. The Inuit approached, and through the window, the Inuit saw the Norsemen laughing and playing with Amarnak's head, which was being spun on a stick like a wheel of fortune. Upon seeing his wife's head used as a toy, Amarnak's husband became even angrier. They barricaded the doorway of the house with brushwood and set it on fire. The Norsemen tried to escape from the house, and those who were not killed by fire and smoke were killed by arrows. Suddenly, the Inuit saw a Norseman coming toward the house from the west. It was one of their leaders, the great Olav, who was the only one of the Norsemen who still hunted every day. The others stayed home out of fear of Inuit retaliation. Olav was dragging a huge fjord seal, but upon realizing that the house was on fire, he raced toward the house so rapidly that the heavy animal on the tow line bounced behind him on the ground. Nevertheless, the Greenlanders launched so many arrows at him that he died with arrows bristling out every part of his body. At last, the supreme chief of the Norsemen, Ungartak, jumped from a window, hugging his little son. But Amarnak's husband was in hot pursuit, and as he got closer, Ungartak kissed his son several times and threw him into the big lake to prevent the Inuit from inflicting pain on him and to make better time. The Inuit believed that they had killed all the Norsemen except for Ungartak, but another man, not one of the chiefs, fled aboard their ship, uttering the words about how pretty the Amaralik fjord was. Just then an east wind picked up and the ship disappeared. And from that day on, there were no longer any Norse settlers in Greenland. Now, Thisted explained that there are many variations to the story, and they vary greatly. But the basic bones of the story are the same. What begins as friendly cohabitation includes a competition that ends in the death of a Norseman, tensions brew, and the Norse settlers kill the Inuit, who are in turn avenged in a strategic way that eliminate the settlers from Greenland. And what I find interesting about this inclusion of two opposing characters with children to protect is this. In one instance, the Norse heartlessly kill Amarnak and her infant in tow. And in the later in the story, Ungartak flees with his son, who can be seen as protecting his own son from a massacre by throwing him into freezing water. And I see this comparative explanation as indicating the strength and perseverance of the Inuit on one hand and the self-defeating practices of the Norse in the Greenland on the other. And the same sentiment is present in the archery contest. So, you know, I find that comparison of the two characters with children really telling. I also want to mention a second story published by Thisted, and it's strikingly different. It is about the disappearance of the Norse people from the southern settlement in Greenland. And in this story, it is not the Inuit who drive out the Norse, but invaders that the Inuit refer to as pirates. And in this story, the pirates attacked the Norse settlement repeatedly for several years. And during these raids, the Inuit Greenlanders fled for safety too. But on one occasion, they had the opportunity to take some Norse women and children with them. And when they returned, the entire Norse settlement had been burnt to the ground. And the women and children remained with the Greenlanders, who took excellent care of them. But there was never again a Norse settlement on Greenland after that. So that is the two stories that are present in Inuit oral traditions. Now, before I leave these two stories, I should make note here that the second story was substantiated by a papal letter from 1448. The letter makes it clear that the Norsemen had requested the help of the Pope in rebuilding their country after having been attacked by quote-unquote heathens living on nearby coasts. Now, it may be obvious to the listener, but I have to mention that the Norse made enemies in their travels. They're known for pillaging towns wherever they went and taking women captive for their settlements on Iceland and Greenland. This, too, is substantiated by archaeological and DNA evidence, as I mentioned with the boat burial. The migration story of the Norse to Iceland and Greenland was one of necessity. There were many factors that contributed to their demise in trying to resettle in a land that demanded a new way of life. The crucial thing that would certainly have made the difference was a better relationship with the Inuit, who had the knowledge and the skills to thrive in one of the harshest environments on Earth. They had been doing so for thousands of years. The refusal of the Norse settlers to openly embrace new ways of being, to adapt to a new landscape where they sought refuge, was the deciding factor. Both stories, even though they're very drastically different, tell the same tale. Our way of life, in all its daily minutiae, must make as few enemies as possible while caring for your family and friends in a way that ensures a thriving future. Our actions today will live on in the stories our children tell. Do we want the stories that they tell to feature a cautionary tale of what not to do, or stories of wisdom that help the next generation thrive from your successes? Not just for the sake of keeping traditions alive, unchanged in a desperate attempt to revive some romanticized version of the past, or to keep our sense of identity intact. When we flee to unfamiliar places, with cultures and ways different from our own, when the environment changes, it is a challenge to our sense of who we are and what we know. It takes courage to adapt, to learn a new way. Resistance to satisfy our ego or impose our sense of power and stability on an ever-changing environment is a futile task. I find it fitting that people named most often in Norse settlement histories are Thorvald, exiled from Norway for settling his disputes with murder, and then his son in turn is exiled from their new home in Iceland for the same pattern of behavior, leading to Leif Erikson, sent to search for new lands, new resources to maintain their old dysfunctional ways. Pillaging and moving on with the ghosts of their past fast on their heels, seeking revenge. Kirsten Thisted says it the best in her concluding statement in her research. The Norsemen have become a symbol of a far deeper conflict than just that with the other. In written Greenlandic literature, where the motive lives on, Norsemen are symbolic of both strangers of and strangers within. I see the persistence presence of Thorvald Eric the Red and Leif Erikson in the Canadian canon of history as evidence of how European settlers valorize that stranger within and feed it continually. In my grade 6 lesson, these men were tragic heroes. In the Inuit stories, the Norse settlers are examples of obstinate strangers, dooming their own fate. Knowing only one perspective of Norse migration and settlement is a fragmented history of a fragmented people. A more balanced, well-rounded history acknowledges the stranger of and within. Wounded hearts that sought healing by hanging on to the very past that wounded them. A wound so deep that the opportunities to redefine themselves, generation after generation, could not be seen. Hopefully, in some small way, this story can contribute to an understanding of a well-rounded history that helps us heal our wounds and feel whole. Then, maybe, just maybe, when we get to that place within ourselves, we can extend our friendship to each other again with a new outcome this time.